Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, we've got a real treat for you, a show that is all about kids and parents and things that might keep them all up at night. We've got Errol Fox Johnson joining us. She is privacy counsel with Common Sense Media. We've got the return of Sarah Pearson to the show to talk about these issues, and Megan Maroney, our very own Megan, from many, many shows at TWIT. We're going to talk about things involving the social web and legislation and various crimes, emoji crimes even, that are of particular interest to parents and kids. All next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWIL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 339, recorded March 11th, 2016. The Internet is Angry. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/twill. And by PillPack, a full-service online pharmacy that combines modern technology, convenient packaging, and personalized service to make your life easier. Visit pillpack.com/twit to save $20 on vitamins and OTCs when you transfer your prescriptions. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all of the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell. Thank you so much for joining us for This Week in Law. We've got an excellent panel of folks joining us here today. And if you're a parent or perhaps a youngster, I think this show will be of particular interest to you. We're going to talk a lot about privacy and IP and various other aspects of the technological world and online communications that impact young people in particular. We have a great panel of folks doing that with us here today. I'm guessing we're all parents. We'll go around and make sure that that's the case as I introduce our guests, so we at least have that interest in the subject matter. Joining us from the TWIT studio is Megan Maroney, who our listeners will know as host of Tech News Today here on TWIT, and Tech News Tonight, and iOS Today, and i5 for iPhone, and the long ago host of Jumping Monkeys, which was one of my favorite ever shows that we've done. It's great to see you here, Megan.
Oh, thanks for having me, Denise. I am all the things you said and not a lawyer. So I stand before all of you amazing people, and I might ask more questions than I give answers, but I'm excited to be here.
We're excited to have you too. And in fact, we're doing this show today largely because of Megan, because she did a segment for one of the local news outlets in the Bay Area on photographing kids in a school context. Isn't that right, Megan?
Yeah, it was. They needed someone to talk about what rights parents had in terms of teachers and schools putting their children's pictures on Facebook or Twitter or other social media. And I emailed you and I said, well, what legal rights do kids have, do parents and kids have? Because usually we think about kids being the ones that are posting pictures. But when the schools and the teachers, what right do parents have for the kids' privacy? And you gave me lots of resources that I used, and that started a conversation. And here we are.
Yep. We're going to talk about some of those resources today and hopefully help answer that question further for people who are interested in their kids' rights around photography, et cetera. We'll get to that later in the show. But the discussion, the email exchange with Megan made me think that, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about technology policy as it impacts the world at large. But when you talk about tech and young people, different unique concerns come to mind. So I wanted to do a whole show where we're sort of approaching our usual subject matter from that standpoint. And I'm really happy to bring back my former co-host, Sarah Pearson, to help us have this conversation today. Hello, Sarah.
Hey, Denise. I'm excited to be back. It feels like a really long time.
I know. It feels like way too long. Sarah is senior counsel at Creative Commons and a mom. and a soon-to-be mom again, correct?
Correct, yeah. I'm just starting my ninth month, so I'm very pregnant. And then I have a 3.5-year-old as well, so... And I'm not, I am a lawyer, but I am not a privacy lawyer. So I'll be on equal footing, I think, with Megan in terms of having any sort of expertise in this area, but I certainly have an interest.
Right. And I we have some IP stuff we can talk about around kids too, that I want to get to in the show. Finally, on behalf of Megan and Sarah and me, and I think every parent out there, I'm thrilled to welcome and to thank for her work at Common Sense Media, Ariel Fox Johnson. Ariel, great to have you.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Ariel is privacy counsel at Common Sense Media. And if you're someone without kids, you may never have heard of Common Sense Media. If you are someone with kids, you are probably on their site multiple times a day because it's just such an invaluable tool. Seriously, I don't know how my parents' generation were able to parent without something like Common Sense Media. And what wound up happening back in those days is my parents dragged me along to things like Midnight Cowboy and The Running Man with Dustin Hoffman, you know, R-rated movies that they thought, oh, you know, it can't be that bad. And, you know, I bear the scars to this day of having seen movies like that as a youngster. So, Common Sense Media helps you know exactly in a very fine-tuned way that goes way beyond the rating systems that we have for television and movies and video games, what you're likely to encounter in that particular piece of media, and lets parents make their own judgments about whether that's the right thing for their particular kid. So thank you so much, Ariel. Just can't tell you how much we enjoy the site and appreciate it being there.
Wonderful. And we're, you know, committed to empowering parents and kids to make smart choices about their media use. And we have, which I'm part of, a new advocacy arm, Common Sense Kids Action, which is dedicated to making kids America's number one priority. And so a lot of what I do on that front is focusing on kids and privacy and technology issues. So I'm excited to be here today.
That's so great. I love the way that Common Sense Media involves kids in the review process. I often find that the kid reviews are the most valuable ones for me because the kids tend to be much more open-minded, I would have to say, or lenient about what they think another kid can handle. And oftentimes I think they're dead on, that maybe parents are a bit more protective than that you or I or anyone else might be. And it's nice to hear the kid's perspective on something like, well, I played this game already and this game already and this game already. So if you're looking at this one, it's really no different. And sometimes they'll give you, you know, very fine grained answers as to small minor differences that might be of concern. So it's neat that they're involved in the site to the extent they are. And it sounds like what you're describing, Ariel, is something that will help them be much more involved and engaged in questions of privacy that affect them. Am I right about that?
Well, we're not directly involving kids in our advocacy work right now, but we are involving them in the site, and we have parent resources and we have kid resources. And a lot of what we're doing is trying to get parents and kids both engaged and talking about what's going on, since that's one of the, you know, main ways we think that parents can be good parents and involved parents in this media world. And kids need to be comfortable talking about this with their parents, with their friends at school, and Common Sense aims to help support that.
Right. So one of the things I wanted to focus on in the show, and I think we'll start with a batch of these kinds of things, is the kind of thing that Common Sense Media, in addition to reviewing various media types on the site, they also have great articles and resources for parents on how to deal with the technological world, what they should be thinking about, what pitfalls or dangers might be out there that parents might not have thought about before. So I think what we will start with today is some crimes that your kid might be implicated in that using technology that you might not have thought about before. So one thing that was much in the news recently that is disturbing or at least catches your attention as a parent is the fact that a 12-year-old girl was arrested for using a gun emoji in a communication. In context, she posted a message on Instagram. It had a gun, a bomb, and a knife emoji. As a result, she was arrested and charged with computer harassment and threatening her school. So, I mean, as a parent, you might have a couple of different takes on that on either side of the spectrum, right? You certainly don't want your school threatened. You don't want your school to be a threatening environment. You don't want kids at your school to be threatened. But at the same time, I think it's not hard to see that kids use emojis in a lighthearted, non-serious way frequently. It's not necessarily meant to be taken as a serious threat. And the fact that a 12-year-old girl was arrested in this context, I think, raised a lot of eyebrows. Megan, did you see this? And what was your reaction?
Yeah, we've reported this on Tech News Today. And my first reaction was that it's one of those stories that I think you see a lot where it's just an age-old story that people want to turn into a technology story. So the first time you look at it, you're like, well, you don't know this 12-year-old girl. You don't know the situation. Obviously, you know, like you said, it's threatening to the other children and to the parents. You also worry about the girl herself. But I think what's also important and a reminder to every parent is to talk to their kids about what they're posting on Instagram or Twitter or anywhere. And whether it's words or emojis, they're there and they can be interpreted in so many different ways by so many different people. And in this case, she was charged with threatening the school and she was charged with computer harassment, which I'd love to get your perspective on that law, because I hear that thrown around a lot and I don't really understand what it means. But also the threat was seen as not credible.
Okay, Sarah, what's your take?
I guess I have a similar take that it doesn't seem like there's really much different about this other than the fact that she used emojis. It could have been a similar case where she used words, and it's all about the context. It seems like a 12-year-old would probably know that even better than, because I don't know, I have a niece that's 13 and she's just used to speaking in emojis. It's just part of the way that that young kids write, as opposed to, for us, it's something new and it's kind of, it seems different, but I think for kids, it's just part of the way they communicate. So I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things, like Megan said, where you see the headline, it's like, oh my gosh, you can get arrested for using an emoji. But on the other hand, it's just another form of communication. So, if it really did look like a threat in context, then it is what it is. Although it sounds like it wasn't actually a credible threat. So then you call into question whether or not these laws and prosecuting under these laws is kind of overbroad and overreaching, which is, I think, a really good question.
Do you think there's any reason to treat emojis as a different kind of communication than words?
I don't think so. I really don't. I think it's just another, another form of communicating through, you know, visually, just like words. So it's, for me, it's hard to see why there'd be any reason to distinguish. Maybe they're a little bit more playful, but, you know, when you're talking about gun emojis and knife emojis and bomb emojis, those aren't particularly playful. So, I don't really see that there is any reason to treat them differently.
I asked my 13-year-olds at home and I said, would you, you know, I told her this story and she said, I said, would you ever use that, even joking? And she said, no, you know, never. Like, I think they understand that it, what it means at that age.
Ariel, what do you think?
I agree with everything people are saying here. I mean, I don't think emojis are different. And I think it's great that we see, you know, if a parent can talk to a kid about emojis and what they would use, that's wonderful. But unfortunately, some kids don't understand that posting this online, different than saying it to your friends, creates a permanent digital record, immediately goes public, or could reach an unintended audience. And that's something that kids sort of need to be aware of these days and that parents need to make sure to talk to their kids about.
Right. I forgot to ask you at the top of the show, Ariel, if you are a parent.
I am, mm-hmm. but I have a baby who is not, using the computer.
So you're at least preparing yourself for the onslaught to come.
Yeah, who knows what technology will look like then? I have no clue.
Right. So in similar vein, Professor Eric Goldman, one of our favorite guests to have on the show, has his wonderful technology and marketing law blog, where he covers cases like this. And one recent case that he's written up fits very well into our discussion here. And it had to do with a teen who tweeted about murdering, and there was a prosecution, chance of liability under a cyber stalking statute. And that one went the other way. No one got arrested. No one, I guess maybe in context, they decided that it did not rise to the level of something that would be a threat. Sarah, did you take a look at this one?
I did, and I couldn't, I hesitate to even bring this out, but when I read it, I couldn't help but remember back when I was a very silly, I think eighth grader, I mm-hmm. wrote something on a desk about like killing our student teacher, which is horrifying to even say out loud. It was mm-hmm. totally a joke, obviously, and it now, I don't know if it's just because I'm an adult or if it really does seem different now that there's been so much. I don't remember, you know, school shootings or anything even being like it wasn't a thing in the media. But anyway, it just made me think, like, God, because when I read this, I was like, this is horrible. But then I remembered that I did, in some ways, you know, I'm just as guilty. So, this seems like probably the right result, but also, kind of, I don't know, just it's horrifying to think about how now everything that you, what I would have done then, you know, was private and nobody saw it, but the teacher, I remember having a conversation with him, but thankfully it wasn't on Twitter or in public. So it's just kind of, it's magnified, the teenagers and young kids do now. And in a scary way, I think.
Right. Professor Goldman gives this pro tip in his article. Pro tip, never tweet the word murder all by itself without some context. It will freak people out. Right. And apparently this particular teen saw some red paint on the school grounds. Who knows if she was thinking of Amityville or what, you know, prompted her to just tweet the word murder. They're in context with other tweets that that she had put up, it put her under suspicion of perhaps cyber stalking, wanting to hurt someone, etc. This obviously you wouldn't want your child to wind up in this situation. So I think Professor Goldman's tip is a good one. But also, it raises the concern of whether these laws are so broad that they're capturing conduct that we would think of as speech or, you know, teenage angst or, you know, certainly I don't think anybody would think that Sarah scratching something on her desk in frustration as a teenager is something that should have necessarily haunted her. Although, you know, so you never got in trouble for that one, huh, Sarah?
Well, so the teacher, I mean, he didn't report it to anyone. He definitely sat me down after class and we had a conversation about it. But it's interesting. It didn't haunt me. I completely forgot about it until I read this. And I was like, I just had this memory like, oh my God. And it's just this horror that you feel about things that you did as a kid. But yeah, he didn't report it to the, you know, I'm sure I could have theoretically been suspended and they told my parents and everything, but he didn't take it seriously enough to do anything about it, which to his credit, I'm very thankful for.
Right. But. Right. And in the absence of a stalking or harassment statute to prosecute you under, you know, I'm sure that sort of remedy never crossed his mind. But today we live in a different world. Ariel, what's your take on this?
I mean, I think your question about whether these capture teen angst or speech is a really good one. And it's one reason that there should, from common sense's perspective, there should be special protections for kids and teens online, because teens are more apt to just post things without thinking or scroll. I mean, I would never as an adult scrawl something into a desk, but, you know, maybe as a teenager I would have. So these, you know, you have to take each case as it comes, but there's a reason that we should be doing things to give teens and kids breathing room online so that they can grow and make mistakes and not have their sort of expression and interest in challenging themselves be squelched because they're worried about consequences that might happen in criminal prosecutions.
Right. And parents have their own concerns about ways they can be prosecuted, at least in France now, that might not have ever crossed anybody's mind in the past. We're going to talk about that and the photography issue that we mentioned at the top of the show in a moment. But before we go there, I'd like to thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is FreshBooks. If you're a freelancer or small business and feeling stressed out by stacks of receipts, spreadsheet formatting nightmares, and not enough time to deal with it all, we've got the solution you've been looking for, and it's FreshBooks. Our friends at FreshBooks have created ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software that makes dealing with your taxes way less taxing. Getting started on FreshBooks couldn't be easier, even if you're not a numbers person. You can create and send invoices efficiently, plus get paid online quickly with FreshBooks payments. You also have the option to request a deposit in FreshBooks and get paid up front. No more covering costs out of pocket or waiting until the end of a project to get paid. And they've made it incredibly easy for you to track your billable time. FreshBooks recently announced their new EMV chip card-enabled card reader. Now you can easily accept credit cards wherever business takes you, quickly, securely, and easily with their entirely redesigned iPhone app. Plus, create beautiful invoices in just seconds. With FreshBooks, you can focus on what you love the most, growing your business. You'll wonder why you didn't start with FreshBooks sooner. Getting started is simple, and it's totally free for 30 days. Go to FreshBooks.com/Twill, and don't forget to enter This Week in Law in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Start your 30-day free trial today. Thank you so much, FreshBooks, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, so hard on the heels of our discussions about this, Megan, it's quite interesting that in France, folks have decided that parents are going too far with this photography thing. Can you tell us what's gone on here?
Well, it looked like that in France now it's illegal to, or there it might soon be illegal for parents to post their own children's photos on Facebook. So, that just it sounded crazy to me. But yeah, I guess that's what might happen in France.
Mm-hmm. The police, I guess, have cautioned parents. They wrote their own Facebook post, telling people to be careful about posting photos of their kids, and have reminded them that they're responsible for protecting their children. And then what we have in play here is the fact that European privacy laws tend to be stronger than those that we're familiar with here in the US. And it's causing folks to speculate that under French privacy law, in the face of this caution, if children are feel that they've been harmed by the posting of parental photos of them, that maybe someday they could be sued by their parents or otherwise face legal consequences. Sarah, what do you think about all this?
I don't know. So I think my initial reaction was that it seems like fear-mongering by the French police about scaring people about posting their kids' photos. On the other, I mean, I guess just simply reminding people of what could happen isn't necessarily a bad thing. The idea of kids being able to sue their parents seems pretty crazy. On the other hand, I do like the idea of kids being able to at least have the right to remove stuff down the road that their parents might have posted that was embarrassing. At the time, it seemed really innocuous because the kid was, you know, like my son's age or something that might be horrifying to him when he's 15 or 16. Although I'd certainly hope that we would be able to just talk about it as a family as opposed to having any, you know, the law get involved. I mean, that to me just seems really, really extreme. But I understand the sentiment, I guess, but just doesn't seem like a legal issue for the state to be regulating.
Yeah, I definitely think that parents would do better about thinking about the permanence of the photos that they post and the things that they say about their children. I mean, we all, I think, have been guilty of that, especially as the internet has changed. You know, I have a 13-year-old. It was very different. I blogged for a long time when my kids were young. I didn't give much thought to the fact that, you know, my pictures of them crying or in diapers or anything that now they can search for and find online. I mean, you know, my kids probably deserve to, you know, have a right to be forgotten law against me. But like Sarah said, I would hope that that would be, you know, talked about at home amongst the family. And believe me, we do talk about it a lot.
Yeah, we talk about it a lot, too. My son likes to say we have agreement. It's a very one-sided agreement. He desires that it to be it is in place. And he says, if you ever post anything about me or of me without my permission, you owe me $50,000. I am strongly motivated not to do so, although I keep telling him we have no meeting of the minds on that. So, Ariel, what is your take on this French cautionary note from the gendarmerie there?
Yeah, I mean, so Common Sense has a lot of resources and guidance on parents and how they can make sure to be smart and limit their kids' digital footprints, not posting, mm-hmm. you know, photos of the first time they use a toilet or other things that might come back and really haunt a teenager, or, you know, how to use sharing settings. I think one thing to keep in mind is that on Facebook, even if you think you're limiting your settings, things can quickly spiral out of your control. And not to fearmonger, but often people post photos of their little children that have geolocation tags. And that's a concern. Or people post like the full birth date of their kid and exactly where they were born. And identity theft is much more prevalent for kids than for adults. So I think there are reasons that parents should take proactive steps to limit what they post about their kids online and what they share, and, you know, think how they would feel in the future, and also just what they're exposing to. There's ways to share and still be thoughtful and participatory in online life, but not, you know, expose your family to everything. And not everyone wants to live on a reality TV show.
Especially on Facebook, I find it sometimes difficult. I will post pictures of my children that I've asked their permission, but then I sort of have stopped saying their names. I mean, I'm in a position where if anyone wants to know my children's names, it's not difficult to find them. But I have stopped using them most of the time. But then, you know, other people will comment using their names, or, you know, it's not just... It's. I think it's important for everyone to recognize that what your own personal boundaries in terms of what you post and say might be different than other people. So take in mind when you talk about other people's children as well.
Definitely.
Right. Go ahead, Sarah.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's really hard to control what other people do online. And so, yeah, you have to be comfortable talking to them or comfortable with what might happen if you post one thing about your kids and then that devolves into further information.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are a couple of other things that come to mind in the context of this discussion. One, you were touching on, Megan, and that is other people's kids and what the consequences might be for posting photos of other people's kids. And I think this comes up a lot at after school kind of programs, camp kind of programs, things that aren't necessarily in the educational context, but are in the extracurricular context, and people get very excited and want to share and document and, you know, might be taking pictures of huge groups of kids or small groups of kids and posting them. And I don't think it's going too far to say that probably every single parent involved in that scenario might have a different view of whether that's okay or not. Have you run into this at all in your own experience, Megan?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, they're, you know, at school, you sign a form and, you know, you counseled me on this when I was talking about it. You know, a lot of people just sign the form and they don't even think about it. And all those forms are different. They're not all the same. And so you might be giving rights to one thing or 10 things, whether you sign it for your child's soccer team or your mm-hmm. school. And so, yeah, I definitely have experience that even here, you know, we've had school trips come through and, you know, people here get excited about it and want to promote it on our website and, you know, want to say this, the name of the school. And it's, you know, and you have to say like, no, there's no reason to associate it with the name of the school and put it on our website that goes out to lots and lots of people. So yeah, I have found that a lot, especially in, like you said, the extracurricular activities. And, you know, everyone's mm-hmm. excited when they, you know, win the soccer game and posting that sort of thing. And so if you are uncomfortable with it, you have to have those kind of uncomfortable conversations.
Yeah. And the other problem, I think what some people and schools will say in favor of posting photos of large groups or just sort of, you know, giving the impression of what's going on or what our school is like, et cetera, posting a photo of students without identifying who they are or where they are or, you know, much personal information about them except for their face, is that facial recognition software is getting really quite good. And anyone who uses Google Photos knows what I'm talking about. That, yes, it's not perfect, but it's pretty darn good. And so the world where an anonymous picture of someone's face exists may exist now, but maybe not for too long. Does this give you pause at all, Sarah?
A little bit. Although on the other hand, I'm just playing out in my head. I mean, these issues are obviously exacerbated when we move online, but the same thing could happen, you know, just going outside, somebody could take a photo of you and mm-hmm. a creepy person and you could, you know, they could use that for creepy reasons.
Right.
So it's just kind of exacerbating something that already exists. So I think it's easy to get like really paranoid about it really fast if you start playing out all the what ifs. But I think it's also important to kind of remember this is where we live online now. This is just kind of the, you know, it's becoming more and more normal to have all of these photos online, which means there are going to be more and more, I guess, examples of horrible what ifs on the one hand, but on the other, it means that there are a bazillion examples of everything being fine. So I don't know. I kind of fall somewhere in between. I'm cognizant of not posting too many photos of my son, although I do tend to do it more on Facebook, which I have my privacy settings set just about as high, I think, as you can. It still is so easy to kind of forget. The thing I've started to become kind of anti-social media because of how easy it is to forget the context. You feel like you're speaking to some subset of the people who are really looking. And it's so easy to forget about like, oh my gosh, I forgot about so-and-so who would read that out of context and not know that about me. Or I thought about it a lot with politics because I say things on Facebook that I would never say with people that I don't know their politics around. So it's just interesting to me how easy it is, even as someone who's, you know, fairly, you know, cognizant of these issues, I still forget the context. And so it's just so easy to do. So I don't know.
Right. I am wondering, Ariel, about, actually, before I go to you, Ariel, let me ask Sarah, wasn't there a case a while ago, several years ago now, that involved a third party, not a parent, I think he might have been a teacher, who took some photos of students and had his Flickr account set so that it automatically applied a Creative Commons license, so that these photos were coming up in Creative Commons searches, and one of them was actually selected and used by a wireless carrier in an ad campaign. So a kid that no one had authorized to be in this ad, I think it was like a bus stop kind of ad, showed up there because of a couple of layers of things going on. One, the photographer who wasn't thinking enough about, gee, should I be using and posting pictures of other people's kids, and wasn't thinking enough then on the posting side about what sort of license he might have been applying. Am I remembering that correctly?
I think, yes, that sounds right. I can't remember the details any better than that. But it is something that we think about a lot, because people assume when there's a Creative Commons license on something that it means you can use it for anything. But mm-hmm. the license only covers copyright and not things like publicity rights, or it doesn't address privacy issues. So it's kind of right. This whole other area that a lot of people aren't thinking about. So it is something that we try to educate about, but it's tough, because most people don't even know that most people don't even understand copyright, let alone the difference between that and other types of protections that might involve people's faces or
right.
personalities.
It's kind of a complicated issue, and I was wondering, I would not want to have to be in the role that you are, Ariel, or that Common Sense Media is, in trying to distill this complicated issue down and give parents advice they can concretely use, that it's somewhere between don't ever take and post pictures of your children or someone else's, and sure, what could go wrong? How do you guys navigate that?
So, I mean, we have a lot of parenting and education experts who are not me, who give, you know, very nuanced and very sort of balanced, just like with our reviews, very balanced and detailed advice to parents. One that we just recently put out is on the homepage of our website right now, sort of a guide to sexting, and not, you know, like, this is how you should do it, guys. how many people really are sexting? It looks like maybe only, you know, under 20% of teens are sexting, and that number drops to 1 or 2% if we're talking about, you know, sexually explicit images. And also just like ways to respond if someone asks you for a sext, and just making kids understand that what they're experiencing is both, you know, normal, and that it's also normal to, you know, not want to participate in sending, you know, inappropriate photos of yourself online, inappropriate in the sense of your parents would think they were inappropriate. But Common Sense also, you know, we talk to parents, we talk to kids, we talk to educators. We try to get all perspectives and think about, you know, what's the right balanced approach here, and what's something that we can recommend that parents feel comfortable with and that kids feel comfortable with. And a lot of that is talking about how these groups can interact and talk to each other about the right thing to do.
Well, I'm glad you brought up sexting, because that is the next topic I wanted to address as a pitfall for young people who might not realize that there are some serious laws on the books in various states that could result in their liability, even if they are a minor. So let's get into that. But my own take on this issue is that a few years ago, and I think this is reflected in the stats you were just giving us, Ariel, the problem was worse. I think that kids have gotten more educated about the consequences of both to themselves and of the bad consequences and the bad impact of victimizing somebody else. But that's just sort of my anecdotal perception of what's going on out there in the world of how teens use technological devices. Megan, do you get the impression I'm heading in the right direction with this, or do you think it's still a big issue?
I think it's still a big issue, but I don't know if the numbers of kids sexting is up or down. First of all, just the word sexting, I can't stand that word. I just, because that's not really what we're talking about. I mean, we're talking about kids sending inappropriate pictures. And so just adding the word sex to it, I think, is what adults do. And that says so much about, like, how uncomfortable adults are talking about this, talking about their kids, you know, becoming, like, older and going through adolescence. It's uncomfortable. And so it's sort of easier somehow to make it into this, the kids are all sexting, you know, it's scary. And the news loves it. You know, the daily news loves it. It's salacious and it's fear-mongering. And so that is always frustrating to me when I hear about that. I think I wish more people would talk to kids about it, really understand what, you know, what their take is. Why are you doing that? I think it's a self-esteem issue. You know, why do you need to do that? Some kids will never feel like they need to send a naked picture of themselves. And they're the same kids that never felt like they needed to do whatever it was, you know, 15 or 20 years ago, that was the thing you did to get attention. So I think there's that. I mean, I don't know the numbers of whether it's going up or down. There's also Snapchat, you know, so maybe, you know, a little more pictures are disappearing. We're not seeing them. There's always that. I mean, of course, with Snapchat, you can always screenshot the picture, but, you know, the person gets a notification of that. So there's not a lot of that happening. So I think there's maybe that. Like, kids are getting smarter about hiding it. Maybe.
Yeah, that's true too. That there are more ways that this can happen in a more clandestine fashion. Sarah, what do you think about the laws that are starting to, or have been over the last several years, clamping down on this practice and how they might impact people who are under the age of 18?
So this is an area where I don't feel very qualified to speak about it. I had the reaction when I saw a couple of the articles talked about a California law, I think it was, that gave schools the right to suspend people for sending inappropriate images with the intent of humiliating or harassing. And that seemed really odd to me, because why would they need a law to have the right to suspend? It seemed completely unnecessary, unless I'm missing something.
Right. I'm assuming they can and do it now without this bill that is pending. We're talking about Assembly Bill 2536 pending in California that would give schools the right to expel or suspend students for sending nude or sexually explicit photos. Maybe there have been instances of students getting expelled or suspended and parents pushing back on that and saying, hey, there's no California law that gives you the right to do that.
Yeah, that's true.
But I'm just not sure, you know, how many cases we're talking about where that might have happened. Ariel, do you think that a law like that is a good idea or no?
Well, and speaking just for myself here, not for common sense, first, I'm just reading, it's a bill right now, as you said. Reading the beginning of the bill, it says right now that existing California law prohibits suspension unless the student does one of several specified acts. So, again, I'm not super familiar with suspension and expulsion law in California, but if that's the case, then it would need to be on a list of acts if they wanted to suspend the person. You know, the bill seems very punitive to me on first read. And in general, I think at least in like the cyberbullying context, for example, we've seen that it's better to have bills where you're encouraging education and you're encouraging awareness and discussion versus things that are punitive and penalty focused. The bill does look to me that it has some education components. But you know, the part that's getting the most press, I think, is the expulsion piece. I also wonder if the bill would, a lot of, you know, separate from sexting is the issue of sort of revenge porn, which is, you know, maybe more scary to some people. And I don't know if the bill as it's written right now would cover that, or would cover sort of third parties getting a hold of images and transferring them. So, you know, I think there are probably ways, you know, speaking for myself, that the bill could be improved and that it could be focused more on education and doing that, as that's been proven in the cyberbullying context to be more effective.
Well, there was the Canyon City case in Colorado that was right before Christmas, I think. I don't know if you heard about it, but that was one that just burst out in the news like crazy because it was ranking pictures. There was a, it was a sexting ring was the term I think they called it. So it was many people in the school were involved and they were ranking photos. There was a point system. It was all the most horrifying things as a parent you could read about. And it was all in the news. And but then, you know, it never really popped back up in the news. But the result was that none of those kids really, you know, were, it was like, oh, they could go to jail. All these football players could go to jail for having these pictures on their phones. No one went to jail. I mean, I think when I read about this morning, it was they just got off on a warning from legally speaking, not necessarily from the school. Like there were consequences in the school, but from legally speaking, because there were no aggravating factors like adults' involvement, posting of graphic images on the internet, coercion, and related unlawful sexual contact. Mm-hmm. So that it was interesting to me because they did do a lot of education. They did all the things that you would want them to do, and they didn't send anyone to jail. That's what we don't often hear in the news media, mm-hmm. that because it's not a sexy story anymore.
Right. No pun intended.
Yeah.
There's a good resource in our discussion points for today, which you can find at tagpacker.com/ let me make sure, /thisweekinlaw. And it's a Law Street piece on the legal consequences of teen sexting, which runs down exactly what you were just saying, Megan, for people who are juveniles. And this again is generalizing across the states, but some of the penalties that they might expect to get are a warning or fines or community service, counseling, probation, and in the last resort, detention. And then in most states, of course, if you're an adult, if you're 18 or older, and you are sending inappropriate pictures of a minor, then you have child pornography issues to consider. And that can lead to jail and fines and also having to register as a sex offender. There was this weird case in Texas a few years ago in 2013 where the highest criminal court in Texas struck down a portion of Texas law that used to prohibit communicating in a sexually explicit manner with a minor with the intent to arouse. So they, at least in 2013, took the criminal aspect out of that kind of behavior. I think that is an anomaly, and I have not looked into whether Texas has since changed the law. It's obviously been a few years since then. But it's just a good reminder that the laws aren't going to be universal on this everywhere, and that once you're over the age of 18, you're not only looking at what might apply to a juvenile offender, but also the very stringent child pornography rules. Let us get into one of the other laws that we do know that all 50 states have now, and that is an anti-bullying law. I want to talk about that in a moment, but first I'd like to thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is PillPack. Now, you know that we all take various things in our lives to help promote our health, whether they're prescription drugs or supplements. They involve trotting down to either the grocery store or pharmacy to pick up the pills that you might take to enhance your life. And it's kind of a pain having to go to different physical locations for those resources. And it also can get a little confusing because if you're taking a number of different things, you might not know what to take, when to take it. And you might not want to just take that undifferentiated sack of prescription drugs and vitamins and things along with you as you travel through the world. So there's a wonderful transformative piece of technology and service that is working to make your life easier in that regard. It's called PillPack. It's a full service online pharmacy that will make you wonder why you ever settled for a traditional pharmacy. PillPack delivers your medications and vitamins in pre-sorted, easy-to-tear packets. I happen to have some right here that I can show you, comes in an organized box with pictures of each of your medications on there so that you know what it is it's supposed to look like. And then as you go through your day, you'll have these packets that are timestamped and contain exactly what you're supposed to take if you're supposed to take any particular thing at a particular time. This also makes it really easy if you're traveling to take these along with you and know what you're supposed to take on a given day rather than having to just throw all your bottles or even worse, all the pills themselves into one location and then try and suss it out later when you go to take them. They use advanced technology to create personalized packets for each customer, as you just saw, and they're always checked by a pharmacist prior to being shipped. Pill packs go through an image recognition system that are built to ensure the right pill is in the right pack. Their system can detect dispensing accuracy by size, shape, color, and density of each pill, and catalogs an image of every single packet dispensed. You can even order inhalers, creams, and diabetes supplies, and they come in refrigerated, easy-to-open packages. Switching is easy. You can sign up on their secure site, and they'll take care of everything for you. PillPack's pharmacists are available 24/7, so you can speak with them from the privacy of your own home or if you're on the go. They proactively contact your doctor and manage your refills so you never run out. You don't have to call your doctor and say, hey, get that prescription over to the pharmacy, I'm out. They do that for you. Compatible with most major insurance plans, including most forms of Medicare Part D, there's no extra cost beyond your standard copays, and shipping is always free. Try out their referral program. If you refer someone to PillPack, they'll donate $100 to RX Art, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to help children heal through the extraordinary power of visual art. PillPack has a medication reminder app too for the iPhone and Apple Watch, so you're never going to miss what you're supposed to take at the right time. So why continue to endure your existing pharmacy? PillPack will not only bring your pharmacy into the digital age, but they will make your life much easier. So here's what I want you to do. If you visit pillpack.com/twit, you can sign up right there. Their site is beautiful. It only takes 5 minutes to sign up. When you use our link and transfer your prescriptions to PillPack, you'll get a credit for $20 worth of vitamins and over-the-counter type things you might buy at a pharmacy. That's pillpack.com/twit. Thank you so much, PillPack, for your support of This Week in Law and for organizing that difficult part of our lives. All right, speaking of difficulty, bullying is something that has been much on the mind of parents and students over, I would say, the last decade at least. Now we have bullying laws in all 50 states, and they appear to be curbing this kind of conduct. Now, I know that there is a lot of hand-wringing about the differences between those laws and whether they might be capturing activity that maybe once upon a time might not have been viewed as bullying. People do have concerns that they are overbroad and perhaps quelling of various other rights that we hold dear, such as speech. So I wanted to take our panelists' temperature on the state of bullying laws and how they think we're doing on this front. Ariel, let's start with you.
I think it's good that states are trying to address bullying. I think in some instances, it's been a while since I've specifically read any in detail, but going back, mm-hmm. some instances, they definitely are very vague and would be very difficult to enforce given free speech rights that students have. As I mentioned before, I think it's better generally when they fall not on the punitive side, but on the education side, and that's when you see things start to go down. I mean, I don't know that cyberbullying is really that different fundamentally from other forms of bullying, so it's something that schools have traditionally addressed. They just need to sort of address it now on a new platform, but I don't think that should change mm-hmm. the way in which they address it.
Yep, I think that's a good take on it. How about you, Sarah?
Yeah, I tend to agree that anything that is more, to the extent the laws are focused more on having states, requiring schools to have anti-bullying prevention policies and setting standards for those, it makes sense. But I do get nervous about the criminalization aspect, just wondering whether there's really any need for anything specific, because like Ariel said, it's not really anything new. This isn't a new phenomenon. It's just the, you know, where you can do it is new. So there are new ways of bullying. But I'm also a little bit skeptical of articles like the CNN one that was in the show notes that kind of just say flatly that it appears that the laws are working. And so I was trying to kind of quickly look at the study that they were citing. But it's hard, but you know, without really digging into it, it's hard to judge it, but.
Right. What they're saying is the Centers for Disease Control, has been surveying, tracking information, collecting data about bullying since 2005. And in 2005, 28% of students were reporting being bullied. I think these are all high school students. And now it's down to, 20% bullied at school and 15% saying they were bullied online. And also, they reference a study, from the Journal of the American Medical Association Pediatrics suggesting that, the laws seem to be working, to deter and cause that reduction in the reported episodes of bullying. I don't think anybody thinks bullying has gone away completely, and certainly there are other avenues to do it now than perhaps when we were all growing up. But perhaps the fact that there are laws on the books and that schools seem to be very vocal about their having zero tolerance of anything that can be considered bullying, that it might be having a good impact and pointing us in a better direction. Do you think that's happening, Megan?
I think recognizing the problem is great. Over recognizing the problem is unfortunate. I can only speak from a personal, from my personal experience with this and my kids. I have two boys and a girl. So, you know, there are really different standards. And I think, a lot of time, I mean, we were all, girls in middle school. So we probably all remember this, that, you know, with girls, the bullying is often very secretive, in the past, especially secretive. It's not something you see. You don't see hitting necessarily. You just see the chatter and, you know, the mean girls and all that stuff. And it isn't seen as much as, you know, and boys, are, you know, it's more physical. And so you would see it and be able to, you know, to discipline it or not in some cases. But with cyberbullying, I think then that's when it comes more to the forefront for girls, which is good. I mean, it's good when you know, parents can see this and it's recorded that one girl is being mean or horrible to another girl. But it's sometimes taken out of context, like we were talking about before. And so... yeah, I think it can go either way. And, you know, as adults, we are really good at judging other parents. So I think that comes into play, too. Like, oh, these, you know, this no zero tolerance. Well, boys will be boys, which I never say that because it's a stereotype. And, it, you know, if you have a girl, you know that, like, you never say girls will be girls. Like, that's not the same thing. You know, girls will be girls is not excusing girls' behavior. It's sort of a mean thing to say about girls there. So, yeah, I think... right. I can't come at it from a legal perspective, but from my own personal experience, it's hard out there.
Yeah. And I think one of the things you mentioned earlier comes into play here too. And that there may be more ways, bullying may be reported less, to organizations like the Center for Disease Control, et cetera, because it may be getting harder to prove in an online context with, platforms that allow you to, mask your IP address or number or what have you. I mean, I think that there are ways that more undercover bullying can take place without you being able to have any recourse against the bullier. And I think in that kind of situation, maybe the victim either is quiet about it because they know there's nothing they can do. Or if they are vocal about it, there's no way to readily locate or even identify the person that's been tormenting them. Any thoughts on this, Ariel?
I mean, I think it's, you, yeah, what you're talking about in terms of the victim maybe not wanting to speak out or not being able mm-hmm. to speak out, there is a lot of anonymous bullying, and there's also a lot of, you know, not anonymous bullying. Age-old problem if the victim doesn't want to speak out about what's happening, and that's another reason that education and awareness and making a place where people feel comfortable talking to their parents, comfortable talking to their teachers, and so forth, can really, you know, help the victims, and it can help the bullies because people can feel comfortable talking to them and teaching them what the right behavior is.
Right. Hey, before we leave this topic of bullying and what might constitute it, Megan, you gave us a link to a story that I hadn't seen before that was interesting, involving a teacher in South Carolina who had her cell phone in the classroom and apparently did not have any sort of lock code on it, or so that it could be picked up and looked at when she was out of the room. And when a student picked it up and looked at it, they found a nude photograph of her that she had taken for her husband for Valentine's Day. And it got passed around the school, and she was ultimately pressured into resigning by her school. That's obviously not a case of bullying, but if it happened to a kid, you might characterize it that way.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And I think, I don't know that it's not a case of bullying. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what the precedent is for forcing a teacher to resign who I think made not the best choice in leaving, in not securing her phone and leaving it out there. But really, I mean, I don't know how they could force her to resign. I think this is fascinating to me. I mean, what they're saying is that she left her students unattended for 4 minutes, and that's why she should be blamed. I mean, my husband's a high school teacher, and you know, high school students can be left alone for 4 minutes. Also, he has a passcode on his phone, and he doesn't let his students use his phone either. So, you know, all those things are interesting, but poor decisions, but not the reason to be fired. And I found this fascinating too, because it's like the school is embarrassed clearly by this and wanted her gone. And I don't know. I mean, legally, how could they force her to resign?
Right. I mean, that seems like a pretty drastic step on the part of the school, but the administrator seems to have said, hey, you let this happen and now, you know, have to deal with the consequences. There is a petition pending in her support. Students and I presume parents and other community members who feel like her privacy was violated, that these photos were illegally obtained from her phone, and certainly was not, you know, an example of her trying to reach out and have any sort of inappropriate relationship with one or more students here. You know, at least she's getting some support from the community, but she does seem to be out of a job at this point and might have trouble down the road. What do you think about this from the privacy standpoint, Ariel?
I mean, as a privacy lawyer, this just is one of those horror stories that you say you really can't control digital copies of things. You know, I mean, there are a lot of best practices here that she didn't follow, like just, you know, securing her phone. But I mean, you really don't, I don't know. You sometimes don't have control of things even on your own phone. And that's, you know, something that people need to be very aware of, because these things, they don't happen often, but they can.
Right. The pro tip here, use your passcode.
Yeah. I mean, then the student is being, I guess the AP says the student is being charged with computer crimes in the second degree and aggravated voyeurism, which are misdemeanors. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've spent a lot of time talking about how kids are, you know, prosecuted when they shouldn't be, but I don't know. I mean, this seemed to be, like, as a high school student, a real violation to pick up her phone, open the app, go to her gallery, take a picture of the photo, then share it and print it out. I mean, that's not a 9-year-old that just picked up a camera and took a picture of themselves and texted it to someone and needs to be told not to do that. You know, this is an almost adult, I think.
Right. Do you agree, Sarah, or do you think that a kid sees a phone, it's fair game?
I mean, I certainly think it's, you know, morally wrong, and I'm sure that the kid, if they have any sort of conscience, feels horrible now, or if not now, in a few years, they will. But I also don't think it's that crazy. I mean, I just think about when I was in high school, nobody had cell phones, so it wouldn't have applied. But this sort of behavior does not seem out of the realm of possibility of all kinds of, like, people who I know now have turned into, you know, great human beings. So to criminalize it seems pretty extreme, because that will affect the rest of their lives. I'm sure they also didn't necessarily think the teacher would be fired. I mean, the teacher in this case, like, to me, almost did literally nothing wrong other than the passcode issue. Mm-hmm. But that's just carelessness. Like, she didn't send it. She only sent it to her husband, you know. It's just really, to me, I'm very sympathetic to this poor teacher. And in the article, I thought it was really brave and also, and great that the teacher said she's forgiven the student, because it's not, you know, teenagers are teenagers, and it's kind of hard to expect them to be perfect. Which I guess means that she, even more, that she should have used a passcode and not left her phone out. But it, you know, maybe this is the only time she did that all year, and just, it was just a moment of carelessness. And I don't know. It's just it's a sad situation to me. Really horrible.
Yeah, it makes me think of what you said before, Sarah, when you know, it was the teacher just sat you down and talked to you, had a conversation with you about it, you know, and you grew up to be a perfectly successful human being, you know. And so it's just how great would it be if that's how we could solve all these problems, by someone just sitting down and having a conversation and saying, like, let's think about what you just did. Right. Unfortunately, we live in a, those pictures are everywhere now. I mean, they're on the internet. They're you know, they're out there. So it's not just about a conversation anymore. It is that.
Right.
Yep. Right. Well, let's make passcode, please, our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We put these phrases into the show. If you are listening for continuing legal education or other professional education credit, if you need more information about that, head on over to wiki.twit.tv. Find our show page there, This Week in Law. We have a whole page for lawyers who are interested in MCLE credit in the United States, of your various oversight boards and how you can submit an application to receive credit for watching or listening to the show. And we put these codes in case you have to demonstrate that you actually did that and didn't just put episode 339 of This Week in Law down on a list somewhere. So passcode, please, is our first phrase, and we'll put another one in before the show is done. We've been talking about things that impact parents and kids and law enforcement in general. Let's talk about some specific to the social web. So here is another example of Europe having a law that might impact us or cause us to have discussion and think about similar laws here in the U.S. In fact, California does as well, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But recently, this month, folks in the U.K. are being warned that those who set up fake social media accounts impersonating another person or you know, not being their legitimate self, I suppose, on social media could soon face criminal charges if they are creating those profiles with the intent to harass, humiliate, or troll others. And the California law I was referring to, we've discussed a couple of times on the show. It was passed a while ago, but it just went into effect at the beginning of this year. It went into effect. There are some other laws that we just got this year. This one has been on the books in California for some time. Actually, it was January 1, 2011 that it went into effect. And that, people may not know, but malicious digital impersonation is a misdemeanor in California that comes with fines of up to $1,000 or up to a year in jail. So once again, I wanted to run this by our panel and see how they feel about laws in California, the UK, and possibly elsewhere that make it a crime to have a fake social media account. And notably, it's not just enough for criminal liability to have a fake account, but to be using that in a malicious or harmful way. Sarah?
I mean, I'm nervous about these kinds of laws. I remember the specific California one, but I've heard about this sort of thing being policed by the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Mm-hmm. And while there are situations where you don't have sympathy at all for the people that get prosecuted under these laws, it also can easily start to seem like a pretty extreme solution. And if you apply it in, especially with the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, if you apply mm-hmm. it to someone creating a fake Facebook account, that potentially, I think everyone, they have prosecutorial discretion, so hopefully it would never come to this, but you hear claims of, you could be prosecuted for, people make those kinds of accounts all the time, having no idea that that it's against the law. Of course, most of the time, I think they're made for a joke and not, anything malicious, which is this California law, like you said, is specifically geared toward the malicious. But I don't know. I'm cautious about these sorts of laws because they just seem like they could be quite overbroad. And I wonder whether or not they're really necessary. But on the other hand, mm-hmm. it is many times hard to sympathize with the people that get in trouble under them. So.
Right. I bring it up in the context of our show today because it strikes me as just another form when applied to juveniles of an anti-bullying law. Again, just sort of anecdotally, what I see among the peers of my own child is that it's probably more common to have a fake online profile than it is to have a real one. So if you take that and you couple it with something that winds up harassing, humiliating, trolling, or otherwise maliciously harming someone, this is yet another way that you can be prosecuted as a criminal, at least in California, the UK, I think in Texas, and probably elsewhere. Megan, does this make you, does it keep you up at night as a parent, along with the various other ways that your kid could get in trouble?
Sometimes it does. All kinds of things keep me up at night. But yeah, I think, there's not only the creating of a fake account, but what I see a lot is logging into someone's account as them. And that is something, especially when kids have iPads in schools and have, Google accounts at school and are not taught right away to keep their password secret. Then that's something that I definitely have seen. So, that's impersonation of a kind. And it's insidious, too, because, we take emails that we receive from someone as who that really, that really coming from them. So I think it's similar to profiles. With kids, it is definitely something that I have seen as a way for kids to bully each other and with adults. There's definitely a difference because I've had parody accounts made of me that were intended to be amusing and also intended to be hurtful,
And how do you feel about the fact that those parody, there's now criminal liability that could be attached to that kind of activity, at least here in California? You think that's a good thing?
No, I don't. I don't think it's something that needs to be criminalized necessarily. But that's been my own personal experience. I've never been harassed in a way where I felt threatened, where my life had been felt threatened. But I know people have. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Ariel, what do you think about this?
I echo a lot of the sentiments that people are sharing. If you're to the point where you feel like your life is being threatened, then there presumably should be some other law that's already there to protect you. So it's not clear why all these sort of very specific social media laws exist. At the same time, as Sarah said, there's not a lot of sympathy for these people. And as I think you mentioned, Denise, kids are more and more likely nowadays to take what might be considered privacy protective steps of creating fake accounts for no malicious purpose whatsoever. So when you're already talking about people being malicious or already talking about people being threatening, why isn't that already wrapped into something else? And why does this need to be a separate law? I don't know.
Right. So the two laws I alluded to earlier that went into effect this year, one is an eraser law that allows folks, it's a pretty vague law. And I think since it's so new, it's only a few months old in effect at this point, it's going to be hard to see how it plays out. But the idea behind it is that if you're a minor, it's like a right to be forgotten kind of concept. If you're a minor and you've posted something embarrassing online, you now have the ability under this law to go to the service provider and ask that it be removed. Now, I'm not sure why you can't just go to the service provider, launch your account, and delete whatever it is that you don't want there anymore. But apparently, this is yet another step you can take. It maybe somehow it's not under your control, and if that's the case, then you have this law to help you out if a person who posted when they were a minor wants something to renew. It puts a whole lot of burden on businesses to comply with this. It's a little bit confusing who can request removal. If you have to be a minor at the time that you made the request, or if you can be, you know, a young non-minor adult and go, gee, I really shouldn't have done that when I was 16, and go make a takedown request under this. Again, it kind of strikes me as a law that has good goals, but might prove to be cumbersome and unnecessary in execution. Ariel, have you looked at this, and do you have any thoughts?
Yes, I have. I do. And Common Sense is actually one of the we worked with the author's office on the eraser button bill, so we're supportive of it, and we've been supportive of it and aspects of it in other states. Part mm-hmm. of the aspects of it involving marketing. That I don't think you touched on were just passed in Delaware last year. And I think the law has been in effect since 2015. So I think some of the criticisms that you just raised are maybe a bit contradictory. And they're ones we heard from industry for sure. You know, why do kids need the ability to remove what they post? Companies already let you do that on the one side. And then on the other side, well, this is really expensive for companies. So that doesn't make a lot of sense. I think here, there are a lot of good actor companies who are letting kids remove what they post, and they're letting adults remove what they post, and that's wonderful. But then there are other companies who aren't doing that. And as we've been talking about on this show, you know, kids and teens need space to grow and express themselves. And sometimes they do stupid things online. Sometimes we all do stupid things online. And all the Eraser Button Act does is let a kid or teen, you know, a minor, remove or ask to be removed content that they themselves have posted. They can't ask for something that someone else does or posts to be removed, mm-hmm. but they can ask for content they have posted to be removed, which a lot of good actor companies already do that nowadays.
Right. And is your take on it that you can't decide once you're 30 to take down something that you posted when you were a minor, or can you?
So I've seen in this law, you know, there have been similar legislative proposals in other states, and states have written this in different ways, and I think Washington was considering a law that would allow anyone to remove postings. My personal take on this is it says permit a minor who's mm-hmm. a registered user. So if you're a minor, then you'd be allowed to request removal. And reading this on its face right now, I don't see why you would be a 30-year-old and therefore be able to request a removal. But that's sort of my quick take thinking about it right now. I know when I was looking back at other states, some of them, it seemed more clear that if you were older, you could remove something that you posted while you were a minor, which is slightly different language.
Right. Thank you for reminding me of when it went into effect. It was not this year. It was last year. And it's just evidencing how I'm unable to drag myself into 2016 here quite yet. It's 2015 still. But it is not. Time flies. What were you going to say, Megan?
I was going to ask, so you can have things removed that you posted, but if you posted something that is now someone reposted on another website, can you have that removed?
No, you can't.
Yeah. It's still playing itself out. I haven't felt like, I don't know how this is going to play out for business in the long run. If it seems to me like a law that that it's nice to have, but I don't know how many times people are going to receive these kinds of requests. As you said, I think there are many sites that, you know, it's not hard to delete your material. I think that's kind of the rule on social media, that you have the ability to go back and delete something that you posted and might have had second thoughts about. So it does seem to me like a law that it's a good idea, but I just don't know that it's going to be invoked all that frequently. Do you have a sense for people availing themselves of it, Ariel?
So I haven't gotten any stats on how often people have availed themselves of the eraser button aspect of the law. Mm-hmm. I would like, you know, there's another aspect to the law too that prohibits companies on sites directed to minors from displaying targeted ads that are about products that are illegal for minors to buy and or from using personal information from the people on those sites to target ads for illegal products. So that's another sort of protection that the law provides. And, you know, I think we've seen since the law was enacted, or maybe even before it went into effect, I think in sort of our own kind of research on this, companies are doing better than they were a couple of years ago in terms of what kinds of products that they're pushing on sites directed to kids. And that's a good thing.
So right. I think there was earlier last month, there was a story, I don't know if you read it, by Kashmir Hill in Fusion about a girl who had a twerking video that she put up. She was 9 and it has 70,000 views and she couldn't get YouTube to take it down. So is this something that would help with that?
I did not read the article, though I do like Kashmir Hill's articles.
Yes.
I mean, I think if the 9-year-old posting on YouTube already brings up something, you know, probably you have to be over 13 to sign up for YouTube. So that might pose some problems here. If she was, you know, had signed up as a 9-year-old on a site and had posted the material, and the website knew they were taking material from a minor, then they should definitely allow her to remove it. Legally, I don't, you know, kids always lie about how old they are to get on Facebook, YouTube, what have you. I think, you know, millions of children are on these sites. So that might be a wrinkle in why they're refusing to take it down for her. I'm not familiar with the case.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with it either, but it does seem like, you know, if you posted the video, you should be able to take it down. So I'm curious about what's going on there, unless they revoked her account because she was underage and violating their terms of service when she posted the video.
I think someone hacked her old account and changed her password, so she couldn't take it down. That was the problem.
I see. Yeah, so... We'd certainly request under this law and see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this is one of those cases where you would like to be able to remove your content, and you would assume in general that YouTube as a platform would let people remove content that they posted that they no longer want up. So,
right. Yeah. Sarah, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's interesting because my reaction to reading about this law was it seems really innocuous. I mean, I kind of like it. It's hard to see. I wasn't very convinced by Eric Goldman raised the potential speech interests at stake. But if it's only applying to stuff that people themselves post, I think that's shaky. And it just seems like very common sense that, you know, we would want minors to be able to change their minds about things that they themselves posted. It's not a matter of news articles about something embarrassing or, you know, something that's very obviously a First Amendment issue. So to me, I don't really see the harms. You know, maybe it won't be that effective because people can already remove the stuff like you raised. But if so, that still doesn't mean it's hard to see like what the downside is to the law. Although I will say it does seem like almost like a drafting error if it really does say that only minors themselves can remove this stuff. Like, it kind of defeats the purpose because You might not be smart enough to realize that you should remove it until you're in your 20s or 30s.
On your checklist before you turn 18. Hey,
right.
review your stuff. Exactly. You might not be able to take it down later. I think the speech concern is probably more directed to the advertising component, the targeted advertising component of the cousin of the eraser button law. Ariel, okay. Were you going to add something?
Yeah, I was just going to say sometimes people hear about the eraser button and think right to be forgotten, and they're really very different. And the eraser buttons, as Sarah was saying, is just about things that you yourself post and have the right to take down. As you know, we noted, you don't have the right to take down what someone else posts. So the two law, that and the right to be forgotten concept, should not be conflated in my mind at all.
Right.
The other thing I thought when I was reading it was maybe this will help deter people from using copyright in the DMCA to take down things that are not really, that have nothing to do with copyright. You know, we see that so much.
Yes.
People have the copyright assigned to them or whatever it is. And it's, I don't like seeing it used for, you know, ways that it, you know, to treat things that it wasn't intended to treat. So it's kind of nice to see another mechanism for people to actually address these privacy issues in a more direct way, and not having to kind of go jump through hoops with copyright to get things removed, which also makes me think, you know, companies are well equipped to handle the DMCA. And so it's hard to see that this particular law would create some significant burden on top of that. I mean, but again, I don't know. This is just my initial reaction. I hadn't actually heard about the law before prepping for this show. So,
yeah. All right. We're going to thank our final sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law. And I hope you're hungry, because if you are, we've got the solution for you. It's Blue Apron. Blue Apron is an amazing service. I have tried a bunch of these different services that will deliver food to your home. And I've got to say that they can be a little catch as catch can. You might have an issue with the quality of ingredients, for example. I've had produce delivered that wasn't the freshest. You might have an issue with the amount that you're receiving for what you pay, whether you think that that's a good portion size or not. I've certainly used services like this that deliver kind of a tiny little mini meal instead of something that's actually going to fill you or your family up. I've had things delivered that required a whole lot of time in the kitchen as opposed to being easy to assemble, prepare, and serve. Blue Apron doesn't fall prey to any of those pitfalls at all. Instead, you're going to feel like you know your way around the kitchen. You're going to feel like you're eating healthier because you're getting fresh, wonderful ingredients. You know, I've never thought in removing something from a Blue Apron box that this was something that I wouldn't have picked out from a grocery store, except in the sense that they do include ingredients in their recipes that I might not have thought of to cook with. So you're expanding your culinary and cultural horizons by trying new foods as well. And you're saving money because you actually do get a substantial portion for your buck with Blue Apron, as opposed to something small that's not going to fill you up, and as opposed to going out to dinner and or ordering expensive takeout food. In fact, if you order from Blue Apron, you're going to find yourself paying less than $10 per meal. They're going to deliver all the fresh ingredients you need to create a home-cooked meal. They're going to deliver fresh, easy-to-understand, beautifully pictorially illustrated step-by-step instructions. Each meal, too, can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. No more do you have to worry about, gee, did I get to the store? I'd really like to make something nice for dinner, but the day's just been too crazy. So, you know, if you have those days, instead of going, well, I don't really feel like going to the grocery store, I don't really feel like cooking something complicated, so I'm just going to order takeout again. No, Blue Apron's going to solve that for you. And if you have special dietary preferences, Blue Apron makes it a breeze to discover and prepare dishes like mushroom and poblano pepper quesadillas with queso Oaxaca and avocado relish radish salsa, or chicken cacciatore with fettuccine pasta and mushrooms right in your own kitchen. And if there's something you just don't care for, like the mushrooms, for example, we have a family member here in my household who cannot tolerate them, you just leave them out or you give them to the family members that like them. You can cook with ingredients that you've never used before, such as watermelon radishes, farro, and purple potatoes. Recipes are between 500 and 700 calories per portion, so they're delicious and good for you. Right now, you can get your first two meals free just by going to blueapron.com/twit. Check out this week's menu and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. Thank you so much, Blue Apron, for your support in my kitchen and your support of This Week in Law. All right, let us move on and look at what kids are doing online that may or may not be compatible with what sites tell them to be doing. So there's a new study out in the UK, and we've had similar studies in the United States that emphasize that the rule that Ariel alluded to earlier, that you are supposed to be over the age of 13 to use various online services relating to our COPPA law here in the United States, is why you see that 13 barrier in place, that rule is honored more in the breach than the keeping. In the UK, they've found that more than three quarters of children aged 10 to 12 have social media accounts, even though they are below the age limit. Similar stats are present in the United States. Is this something that we're just willing to live with? What do you think, Ariel?
I mean, it's something we're definitely living with. I think I saw a study, you know, Consumer Reports, 5.6 or 8 million under 13 users on Facebook. And, you know, a majority of young people are not following the rules. It's sort of a difficult situation because you want companies to create spaces where kids can go and they don't have to lie about their age. And the companies are still complying with COPPA. And if that doesn't happen, you see that the kids are going to go to these spaces anyways. And then the company will say, you know, we didn't realize it was a child. And we're a general audience site. I think it would be better if companies could create, you know, safe and smart places for kids to explore. I would also caveat that, though, sometimes companies create, you know, kid-safe environments that aren't so kid safe or that parents think are more safe than they are. And there's no substitute for a parent's good judgment here. So it'd be best if companies could create better spaces. And then it'd be best if parents were still involved and didn't just trust that the company was, you know, protecting their kid, in my opinion.
Right. Megan, do you feel like people, the parents, you were talking about how it's easy to criticize other people's parenting. Do you feel like parents are adequately policing this issue, or just sort of turning a blind eye to, you know, you're supposed to be under 13, but nobody really checks that. And, or you're supposed to be over 13. Nobody really is going to check. And the consequences aren't that dire. And I want you to learn how to use social media. So go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it runs the gamut to not paying any attention at all. And, you know, other parents knowing that that are paying attention, that there's kids that are on social media their parents have no idea, to parents, myself included, who say, you know what, you're mature enough to have this, even though the age is this. And it was a difficult decision to make, but I will say that I did, because, you know, I'm the parent and I know. And for me, like, Instagram started out as a good, safe place for my kid to make mistakes, which they are going to, you know. And what's interesting, and I don't think this is my own personal experience. I've seen this across the board that, you know, when a kid that's often their first foray into social media, and when their parents are paying attention, then it's, you know, they are excited when their parents follow them, when their friends' parents follow them. So it's a kind of gated community where a lot of people are watching. I mean, that said, I have two, you know, my boys are 11. They're not on Instagram. They don't care. They don't want to be. But But I've seen a lot of kids even younger than them that are there. And so it's good because everyone's sort of paying attention. And then they take it to the direct message in Instagram. They take it to Snapchat. They move on. They figure out, oh, wait, it's no longer cool for all of, my parents and my parents' friends to be following me, my aunt, my uncle, my grandma. Yeah, I think that I've seen people paying attention. I've seen people not paying attention. It's certainly easier not to pay attention, to just turn a blind eye to it. But it's one of those things where you have to. It's difficult to have those conversations. The other thing that happens if you have an issue, if you've been, cyberbullied, or if something's happened to your account, and then you or your child goes to Instagram or Facebook and says, hey, I had this problem. They can easily say, well, you're not 13. It's illegal for you to be here. Goodbye. We don't have to solve the problem. So you're not protected, really. Right. So there's that side of it, too.
Right. Sarah, do you think sites are doing enough to police the age limits that they have in their terms?
I don't know. I'm kind of torn about it because, I think I've said that about almost every issue here. These are not, these are not clear cut at all, but it is in some ways, it seems like a cop out for sites to say, well, we don't know what age kids are, when it might be really obvious based on their accounts or, anything else. And so if we know that that's the reality, it seems like maybe there's more that we can do. But on the other hand, I'm sensitive in this situation to, imposing a really high burden on, it could make it almost impossible to create platforms. Because I don't know much about COPPA, but I just know that there's a lot to it. And it is, it's not the sort of thing I don't think that you can navigate very well without legal help. So it would be a deterrent to creating platforms if it applied to everyone. So I don't know. I guess, yeah, I don't have a take on it, but it's really interesting to see these statistics, but it also doesn't surprise me at all. So Right. Whether it's just the reality we live in, or, that we just choose to live with and kind of turn a blind eye and just put the onus on the parents, that seems like the way that we're kind of going right now.
Yeah. Ariel, I'm curious, since we're talking about COPPA, and we mentioned earlier in the show that kids come and post on Common Sense Media, and that's actually a really compelling component of what you offer there. I'm curious as what Common Sense's decision as to COPPA compliance was. You have, I think, posts from kids under 13, correct?
We do have posts for kids under 13, and Common Sense is a nonprofit, but Common Sense is very supportive of COPPA, and we've started moderating the post for the kids under 13 so that it doesn't get posted until a human reads it, to make sure that there's no personal information. And if anyone finds personal information, we ask people to flag that and bring that to our attention. We also, for our under 13 users, don't post any, their screen name or anything like that. It just says, kid 11, and then there's your post.
Right. But you're not going the step of you're not considering yourself a site that's, directing its activities toward children. You're a more general interest site, so you're not doing all the parental consent requirements?
So Common Sense is a site that's directed towards parents generally and adults. Yeah. And we have parts directed towards educators. If a kid is logged in as an under 13-year-old when they sign up for our site, then they're treated as a child, and that's different. And when kids try to log in to Common Sense and they say that they're under 13, they have to get give us a parent's email address and get parental consent and permission.
Ah, got it. So you are doing all those hurdles. Let's move on to something that Megan highlighted, and it raises the issue of search and kids, and the fact that there are various options available for you as a parent to put in the way of your child as a search engine that's going to protect them from various things that they might run into online. And it raises the whole can of worms about filtering and censorship and whether these things are worthwhile or not. Tell us what happened, Megan, with the Kittle search engine.
Okay, well, it was a search engine that they were sort of pretending to be supported by Google, but they were really just using Google search. And what people found was that, you know, it, like you said, this is an age-old problem with filtering. It doesn't work. And so what they found was, I mean, I can't believe this was a story that was last week and not 10 years ago that places haven't heard this. So that if you searched for a word like gay or homosexual, it would say, oops, like, that's not here. Sorry. You know, just all kinds of terms, vagina and, you know, suicide. Suicide was one of the things that was really interesting because it said like, oops, not found. Where, you know, if you actually go to Google and you search suicide, the thing that no ads come up, the only thing that comes up is a suicide hotline. Like, you know, they have that stuff dialed in. So it was just really tone deaf, I think, for this day and age. They've since removed those filters so that the words are back, like homosexual, gay, like you can search for those words and they come up, they do bring up search results. So I think it was like menstruation, gay, lesbian, homosexual. These were all blocked as inappropriate. So it was one of those things where, I mean, kids don't always have access to parents that are going to be able to explain these topics to them. Yes, it would be ideal if we all did, but we don't. And so sometimes Google is where they go, and to have those blocked is unfortunate.
Sarah, any take on filtered search?
No, I agree completely with what she said. Like I just think filters don't really seem to work, especially in this sort of, when you get to the level of a kid being old enough to actually type in search terms, they're going to find a way to get around it probably pretty quickly, even if it does effectively censor. So, I agree. It seems like a story from 10 years ago, 10 to 15 years ago. Yeah. It's kind of amazing that it's still happening.
Right. The interesting part for me is that this problem's been around since the dawn of web search, and I think still hasn't been solved very well. That the filters that are available are still pretty, aside from the kind of example that you raised, Megan, where you're going to get information about difficult issues like suicide when you use Google. If you're looking for a good filtered alternative, Google Safe Search has its issues. YouTube Safe Search has its issues. You know, they are not necessarily that useful for parents. Ariel, do you or through your experiences at Common Sense have anything you can add to this?
Yeah, I think this is another example of, it's great sort of that companies are trying to do things that are safe for kids, but you really can't make technology the replacement for parental judgment and talking to your own kids. And I know not everyone has that, and that's something else that we should work on. But sometimes the problems are exacerbated when parents think that they can trust a site or a search engine or something, and it's a safe place for their kids, and it's not a safe place, or it's not a place that has full and accurate information, as we've been seeing with Kittle so far.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is, the solution is not that difficult. The solution is talk to your kids. I mean, that it's something that every parent has to come to, that like your child is going to see pornography on the internet. They just are. It's horrible, but you have to talk to them about it. I mean, in an age appropriate way, like without the specifics, just the same way you would learn to talk to your child about sex. You have to talk to them about what they're going to see on the internet. And it's more complicated than that. I mean, the internet is angry. The internet is angry towards women. Like, these are all these conversations as your kids get older that they're so hard to have, but so important to have.
Yeah. All right, let's move on. Speaking of angry, people were awfully angry at VTech, and it raises the issue of the Internet of Things and privacy concerns that go along with it. So again, this is not, it's a new story in that it happened fairly recently, but it's not a new story in the context of leaks of personal data, which has been happening for quite some time. Here, VTech garnered more headlines than most because it was 6.3 million kids' profiles that were exposed by a hack that they were subjected to. Now, VTech is trying to limit its liability in the future by changing its terms and conditions. I'm sure it's not alone in attempting to do that in its handling of KID data. But that is its latest move in response to the hack that it was exposed to. And of course, it's not a very popular move, but I also don't think the fact that VTech is under the microscope here doesn't mean that other companies aren't attempting to limit their liability as much as possible as well. Eric, Ariel, any take on this?
I mean, this winter we saw a string of either hacked or hackable children's devices with VTech and the Barbie and Hello Kitty toys. So I think it's really coming home to people now that the Internet of Things sometimes does not have built-in security, and these toys can be constantly on and listening to you, and often they might be talking to each other. Your smart TV might be talking to your smartphone and, you know, listening to your whole conversation. So I think it's a very emerging space in the regulatory area, and I think regulators need to start looking at this and provide guidance. You know, COPPA was updated recently to deal with mobile a couple years ago, but now we're sort of well past that. People need to be aware that these devices that they're bringing into their homes, you know, they often haven't fully thought through what they're doing and what they're collecting and why they need the information and how they're going to secure it, unfortunately.
Right. On the web, people at least are presented with texts that they can click through and see a privacy policy. Sometimes they may actually have to affirmatively confirm that they have read and understood. Of course, they probably haven't actually, but they're asked to confirm it anyway. With devices like VTech, devices like an Amazon Echo, et cetera, it seems like, as you say, Ariel, we're in a space that is wide open. And I think it's harder just by the nature of how those devices are used and how people interact with them to even pretend to be able to give people notices of how their data is being used. Do you agree?
Definitely. And I think that's something that the device makers are struggling with, that advocates were struggling with. You know, how do you make it clear to people what they're agreeing to, what the terms of the device are? I mean, people don't understand privacy policies on the web anyways. I think studies show that the majority of people think if something has a privacy policy, it means it protects your personal information, which I think everyone here knows not the case. But, you know, they struggle with how to put privacy policies on mobile phones. So how do we put it on something that doesn't, how do you put it on a bear? You know, how do you put it on something that doesn't have a screen?
He has a nice little locket around his neck that when you open it up, a huge long document unfolds, like the contract from The Hobbit comes spilling out. Sarah, any thoughts on how the Internet of Things changes what parents should be doing about children's privacy and protecting it?
I mean, on the one hand, I'm kind of glad that we can't use the privacy policy kind of legal fiction as a cop out of saying that these types of things are okay, because we all know that no one, including lawyers, like me at least, don't really read every privacy policy of every site. I don't think that would even be logical for me to do. So to expect people to do that is just, we all know it's not happening. It's not the reality. So it's kind of nice to know that there's going to have to be some other solution for these types of situations, which is not, maybe that's not really reassuring, but it, in some weird way, it is kind of reassuring to me. But I also think that this is not the sort of thing, I would love to think that enough people will hear about this, that some company that does kind of provide more guarantees to consumers will prevail in the market because, you know, people will want that security. But I think that's probably unrealistic too. Like, I don't know that these sorts of issues can really get kind of ironed out or managed by the market. So I tend to think that we probably need more regulation, like holistic regulation about handling these sorts of things and who, you know, who's in charge of kind of when inevitably hacks occur, who is liable. It's almost impossible to put that onus on the consumer because we don't even fully understand what it is they're collecting. So it seems like there needs to be more responsibility on the companies.
Right. And aside from just the companies making devices that gather data and then the data that is stored by the company, we all access the internet through our ISPs and wireless carriers. And Aerial has actually been working toward securing more privacy on that front, too. So let's talk about that, looking at what Common Sense and others are asking the FCC to do on the policy front. So you have a post about this up just this week, Aerial, and it's such a good point that aside from all the various other ways that we know that data is being gathered and stored and used about us, the ISP is the channel that pretty much everything flows through, whether you're, and if it's an ISP that also delivers your television service, of course, they have all your television watching habits at their fingertips. If they are providing your internet access service, they know what sites you're visiting, how much time you're spending there. And I think some ISPs actually provide not just landline, but also your wireless service. So you might find yourself, no other choke point might have quite as much data about you as your ISP, your broadband provider. So tell us about the letter that you've sent the FCC on that front.
So last year, the FCC reclassified broadband internet access service under Title II as a telecommunications service. And as part of that, it is supposed to promulgate rules related to how these carriers treat customer personal information. And instead of just applying the old telephone rules, it said it was going to draft new rules for the broadband era, which we think is a good thing. So since January, we've been joining with our allies and other advocates in asking the FCC to now move forward and explain how it wants broadband providers to protect customer information. And this week, we recently sent a letter on behalf of kids and schools and libraries and, you know, all of the community members who use libraries, because some of the pushback we've gotten to the idea that broadband providers should protect information as well. Oh, people can protect themselves. They can use VPNs. They can do this or that and encrypt things. You know, a kid doesn't know to encrypt anything. And if you're at a school or a library, you often can't encrypt things because of the way that the setup to the internet works, and you don't have really total control there. And you at a school have no choice but to use the internet. So this is just sort of one example, and what we feel is a really salient one, of why the burden here should be on the broadband providers to protect information. It shouldn't be something that we're asking our kids to do. It shouldn't be something that we're asking the libraries, who are already overburdened, to try to figure out for their customers, who also probably can't technically implement it either. So
right.
we're you know, excited about hopefully strong rules here.
Do you have any information about how information is being used by broadband providers now? You know, or do you know of any that do aggregate data about their customers and then sell it to third parties?
I mean, a lot of them may aggregate the data and use it for their own marketing purposes themselves to market, you know, different services. But there was sort of the big brouhaha over the Verizon super cookies, which they were putting in everyone's traffic either last year or a couple years ago. And this is something where even people who were trying to take steps to protect their privacy, you know, were being thwarted and there was nothing they could do about it. But, you know, broadband providers, like everyone else in the tech space, is trying to do more and more to aggregate people's information, data mine people's information, and use it in ways to target them with ads and market things. That's just sort of the new business model for everyone online.
Right. All right. I'm reminded I still need to put a second MCLE passphrase into the show for those of you who use such things. And hearkening back to the woman who was attempting to remove her video from YouTube, let's make twerking too young our second passphrase for this episode of the show. We have one final copyright story, and then we'll get on out of here with our tips and resources. But let's talk first about how copyright law is being taught to kids in school. All right, this was a catch by Mike Masnick over at Tech Dirt in looking through the Every Student Succeeds Act that was enacted late last year, went into effect late last year, and it replaced the No Child Left Behind law and has some provisions that affect how Congress was lobbied in passing the law, and provisions that were obviously added to satisfy the strong copyright rights holders side of the equation. Mike's article over at Tech Dirt, you can see he's called out a few places, and there are probably more within the text of the law itself, where every time technology is brought up in the law and how technology will be discussed or taught or resources about technology given to students or integrated into curriculum and instruction, there's a little parenthetical that has been inserted that reads, including education about the harms of copyright piracy. So clearly the MPAA and its friends made some headway here in the enactment of this new law. And it seems, you know, much like the notices that if anyone still watches DVDs appear at the beginning of every single DVD to get you to think about piracy and its ills, they want education to have a similar sort of impact. And they seem to have had some success in getting that kind of law actually enacted. Which is somewhat disturbing. And Megan, you actually pointed to a wonderful resource for educators and others from the EFF about teaching copyright, which mentions things like fair use as opposed to simply hammering on the harms of privacy, which is definitely a more comprehensive, accurate, useful, and informative approach toward teaching copyright law. This was a good catch by Mike, and it's something I think we all have to be paying attention to as parents, that education laws may include some content about a curriculum that you may or may not agree with and should pay attention to as a parent. Megan, anything to add?
No, I was just, it hadn't been something that had been on my radar at all to think that my kids were being taught copyright law in a way that was biased in one way or the other. I hadn't thought about it. So thanks for bringing it to my attention. And yeah, I definitely recommend the EFF's take on how to teach your kids, because it's important to teach kids not to, you know, it's something kids actually have to be taught. Like, don't steal someone else's work and pass it off as your own. But in a more even-handed way, I think.
Right. Sarah?
Yeah, same reaction. I think it's kind of depressing to see this sort of thing, but I also think, like Mike Masnick, I'm really skeptical about how much impact it has, especially when it's so out of touch with how, I mean, I haven't seen the curriculum, but it's easy to imagine that it doesn't address fair use. It doesn't address kind of the pervasive non-commercial reuses that people, including kids, are making all the time of things online. And if it doesn't, then it's just going to be so out of touch with their experience that it's going to be completely, you know, ineffective. So hopefully it won't be that bad.
The disturbing thing about what got inserted into the law is not sort of any kind of let's have a discussion or education about copyright law. Instead, it's you're going to inform children of the harms of copyright piracy,
right?
Which is, of course, just one aspect of copyright law. Any thoughts, Ariel?
Echoing everything that people have said, that it's really important. We want kids to be creators more than they currently are spending time online. They're spending more time consuming than creating, and we need them to learn how to be creators in ways that are safe and legal, but we don't want to scare them by sort of misleading them as to what they can do with content online.
Yeah. All right, good. So we'll go ahead and include the EFF's page on this as one of our resources of the week. That's available at teachingcopyright.org. We have a bunch of resources for you this week. Of course, Common Sense Media is the resource to end all resources if you're a parent, if you're not already using the site and you have questions about any sort of media and whether it's something you want involved with your children or your family, they are the go-to for that. So definitely make it part of your life. There's a new show on the Sci-Fi Network I thought listeners and viewers of the show might be interested in. Just caught the first episode, I think it was the night before last. It's rather sensationally called The Internet Ruined My Life. But it is some interesting stories. There are stories that we often have covered here on the show. The first episode, for example, featured the couple from London who were tweeting in advance of their trip to the United States about how they were going to destroy the U.S. and dig up Marilyn Monroe. Of course, they were just exuberant about their trip and didn't plan to do either of those things, but got detained by Homeland Security and actually not permitted to enter the country. And they were actually put in jail. And it's a good telling of their story. And the other anecdote in the first episode involved the woman who came up with or was responsible for hashtag cancel Colbert and the backlash against her that pretty much ruined her life. So it's going to be stories like that on the new sci-fi show that have definite law and policy of the internet overtones to them. So keep an eye out for that. Two great resources for you if you are a parent or a student. MySchoolRights.com will give you all kinds of information for parents and students about this is a project of the ACLU, various branches of the ACLU in California, specifically as to topics we discuss here on the show. There are cell phone privacy discussions there, how much the school, your school might have to honor your privacy and your cell phone, your social media rights, et cetera, et cetera. So check that out. And also check out the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse Privacy and Education Guide, which is a very comprehensive discussion of what schools can and cannot do in the way of gathering and using data, including photographs about students. So very interesting, good information for you to have as a student or as a parent. And then our tip of the week is for students or parents, children or parents, if something has been posted specifically to Facebook of a child under 13 and you would like it removed, Facebook has a specific form. Unfortunately, they don't have an easy link to that form. So if you go to their help center and search for report photo or video that violates child privacy, you're going to get that page. You can also, of course, pull it up in our links for the show at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. And it helps you out. You can either, if your child's under 13, you can fill out a form on their behalf. If they are between 13 and 17, they can submit their own request to have privacy violative content removed from Facebook. So something that you might want to file away and just know is there should you ever need it. With that, we'll go ahead and wrap up this episode of This Week in Law. It's been a great discussion. Thank you so much. Great to meet you, Ariel Johnson. Anything you want to let folks know about that's going on with Common Sense Media or anything else on your radar before we wrap the show?
I mean, I encourage people to go to commonsense.org frequently to get new tips and tricks and to see what we're advocating for, like right now, the FCC broadband privacy rules. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you. Really appreciate your time. Sarah, great to see you again.
Yeah, great to see you.
Okay, congratulations and best of luck in the next couple of months.
Thank you.
Anything you'd like to update us on? We haven't spoken with you in a while.
Yeah, I was going to just say, I think people should definitely watch Creative Commons in the next year or two. We just got the biggest grant in the organization's history in this last month and have done a lot of thinking about you know, what we're going to do with the money and a new strategy. And so there's a lot of exciting stuff happening and will be happening over the next 5 years at CC. So that's a good time to kind of watch what we're up to.
Great. We will definitely do that. And Megan, thank you so much for joining us as your first time on This Week in Law.
It was fun. Thank you so much. I know I get emotional about these topics, and it's nice to be with lawyers that can, you know, can calm me down a little bit about them. So thank you.
Or, you know, we'll just stir the pot and make you think about things that maybe you weren't worrying about already.
Right. Exactly. Thanks for that, too.
Problem. Wonderful to have you on the show. Wonderful that you all could join us. We're thrilled that you did. If you joined us at 11 o'clock a.m. Pacific time, 1900 UTC, then you've joined us live, and congratulations. We love it when you can do that. If you are someone who joins us live, be sure and jump into our chat at irc.twit.tv so we can chat with you during the show, get your take on things in real time. But if you can't do the real time thing, don't worry about it. Head on over to twit.tv/twill. Our entire archive of shows is there, as well as a handy dandy guide on the various ways you can enjoy the show, whether you want to watch it on your TV or your phone or your tablet. There are all kinds of options there for you, and we're just happy that you can join us. However you do that, you can get in touch with us between the shows too. I'm Denise at twit.tv or D Howell on Twitter. Those are both great ways to reach out and let me know what you thought of our discussion, what you think that we dropped the ball on and should pick up on a future show, guests you think we might want to have on, any feedback at all. We'd love to hear from you, and really couldn't do the show without your suggestions and feedback. So please keep them coming. They're terribly, terribly helpful and very much appreciated. And with that, we'll go ahead and let you get a start on your weekend. Thank you so much for joining us for This Week in Law.